Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for June 29th, 2007. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. In today's show, progress in synthetic biology, how humans have domesticated the world, and thoughts about the role of punishment in the evolution of human cooperation. All this plus our usual roundup of other stories from science and its online daily news site, Science Now. So stick around. Synthetic biology, the creation of new species using computationally derived genomes, took a step closer to reality this week. In a paper published online this week by Science, Carol Lartigue, John Glass, and colleagues at the J. Craig Venter Institute report the successful transplant of an entire genome from one microbial species to another. Science news writer Elizabeth Panisi reports on the story in this week's issue. She's in the studio with us now. Liz, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, Liz, what's this all about?
Well, for decades now, researchers have been doing genetic engineering, where they put in pieces of genes or entire genes into bacteria. What these researchers did is insert an entire chromosome, an intact chromosome, which represents an entire genome from one species into another species of bacteria.
So how did they actually pull this off?
Well, they started off by modifying the genome they were transferring. First, they added a gene for antibiotic resistance. Then they added another gene for an enzyme that causes any bacteria expressing the gene to turn blue. What this enabled them to do is see whether or not the transplant had taken. They then isolated the DNA. They added that DNA to a tube of a closely related bacterium and then waited to see what happened. After 3 days, they saw blue colonies and they tested to see whether those colonies really had the new genome as opposed to the original genome in them. And they did.
So essentially this was one bacterial species had become another bacterial species by the transfer of this genome.
Correct.
And what is that? What does all that mean going forward? That sounds like that sounds pretty provocative.
So one of the goals has been to create an organism that has what they call a minimum genome. In other words, just enough genes to sustain life. And the idea is once you have this minimal organism, you can then add the genes you want to add to sort of get the bacteria to make biofuels or pharmaceuticals or something like that. So the first step, of course, is building the genome, and they're working on that. But the second step, which is related to this paper, is then once you've built this synthetic genome, how do you get it into a bacteria? How do you get it to basically run an organism? So what these researchers did is take an existing genome and demonstrate that you could put a naked genome into another species and have that genome take over that cell.
So it gives a way that if they come up with one of these minimal genomes, it's a way to practically test it, as it were, or insert it into an organism.
Exactly.
So this seems, you know, given the connotations of artificial life, this seems certain to be controversial. Do you have any thoughts on the societal issues that this work raises?
Well, first of all, it's important to realize that this is an important step, but we're still a long way from artificial life. Basically, taking a genome of a really closely related species and putting it into its close kin is way different than taking an artificial genome and trying to put it into a bacteria. So that step has to be taken yet. Now, of course, the researchers in the whole synthetic life field have been discussing these issues since the very beginning, and they're hoping to and planning on coming up with guidelines to keep these organisms from getting into the wrong hands and from sort of being unsafe.
So it's kind of a stay tuned situation.
Yes, it's very much a stay tuned situation.
Liz, thanks for filling us in on this.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Science news writer Elizabeth Panisi reports on new research in synthetic biology in this week's issue. The paper, by Carol Lartigue and colleagues, appears this week on Science Express, the journal's publish before print website. As the name implies, the agricultural revolution that began roughly 10,000 years ago has usually been thought of as a historically sudden Big Bang event. But new archaeological fieldwork, genetic studies, and other investigations are starting to change our way of thinking about the rise of farming and plant domestication. Science contributing correspondent Michael Balter writes about this new work in a News Focus article in this week's Science, part of a collection of articles and reviews on plant domestication in the issue. Michael is on the line with me from Paris to talk about the story. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
It's good to be back. Thanks.
Michael, maybe we could just start by reviewing the standard, the kind of standard model of how agriculture got started.
Well, the standard model has gone through different changes over the years, but for until about 10 years ago, basically it looked as though agriculture started first in the Old World, the so-called Fertile Crescent area that includes Israel, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, southeastern Turkey, about 10,000 years ago, and that it was a fairly abrupt process. In other words, it kind of blossoms very, very quickly, and that it also corresponded roughly with the beginning of the so-called Holocene geological epoch that began about 11,500 years ago. And according to this view, there were other centers of plant domestication and agriculture too. Following fairly soon on would have been China with crops such as rice about 8,000 years ago. But the New World, meaning North and South America, where we have things like squashes and maize or what we call corn and beans and yams and things like that, there wasn't much evidence even 10 years ago that there had been domestication or very much agriculture any earlier than about 5,000 years ago.
Okay, so basically a pretty old world focus picture, agriculture starting in the Near East, and I guess starting fairly suddenly, according to the model that was prevalent up until around 10 years ago, but I guess it's starting to appear that in the Near East, at least, plants may actually have been domesticated much more gradually than has been thought?
That's absolutely right. What archaeologists and botanists are starting to realize now is that rather than just sort of an abrupt process where plants became domesticated, and I should point out that domestication, we refer to what botanists have called traditionally the domesticated syndrome, or the domestication syndrome, I should say, where you have certain traits such as the fact that the spikelets which carry the grains or the seeds stay on the stalk, say of a wheat or barley stalk, rather than fall off easily, so that they hang around until people actually harvest them and can replant them. These and other genetic changes such as quicker seed germination times and so forth, that all of these physical signs and physiological signs of domestication occurred or appeared fairly abruptly. And one of the reasons it might have seemed that way is because until very recently we didn't have the kind of methodology that we do now to sort of detect domestication, and we also didn't have some of the archaeological methods that we have now. But with new archaeological methods, with sort of statistical methodologies, and with new genetic techniques that can help us to trace what genes have undergone selection for domestication, it's now clear that this was a process that went on over thousands of years. Although it appeared to have happened suddenly in the past, it really took thousands of years. And that it was a process that probably began when people started using plants, not even cultivating them, but using them. For example, a site in Israel that was excavated in the 90s showed that wild wheat and barley had been collected by people who were basically foragers as early as 23,000 years ago, but certainly they weren't farming or cultivating those plants. Later on, at some point, we don't know exactly how long ago, but certainly maybe as early as 13,000 years ago or even earlier than that, people began to cultivate wild plants. And that cultivation of wild plants went on for several thousand years before we had the fully domesticated phenotypes or physical morphologies, if you will, of the plants that we, of domesticated plants that we have today.
Okay, so some evidence that in the Near East we had a sort of a gradual process of domestication over thousands of years. What's happening in the New World while all this is going on?
Well, quite a different sort of process of discovery going on in the New World, but ending up in a convergence of the timeline in terms of domestication. So, whereas until really just about 10 years ago, it looked as though there were very few domesticated plants in the New World that were older than about 5,000 years, new radiocarbon dating techniques and some other very cool techniques having to do with identifying plants that grow in the tropics by the microscopic grains of starch that they leave behind and by tiny microscopic microfossils called phytoliths that they also leave behind in the archaeological record, in archaeological sediments or on stone tools, we're really beginning to push back some of those dates so that now with the earliest dates for domestication of squashes is about 10,000 years ago. We've got evidence of maize going back at least 8,000 years ago, and the genetic evidence indicates that it's probably about 9,000 years ago, even possibly peanuts about 8,500 years ago. So we're really pushing back those dates so that the earliest dates for agriculture in the New World, 10,000 years, pretty much now correspond to the earliest dates in the Old World of about 10,000 years. So we're really having kind of a convergence now.
And not just in those two areas. I mean, one of the most interesting things that you bring up, at least to me, is how there's also this growing sense that agriculture was rising at around the same time in a variety of other regions as well.
Well, it's true. In our science story, we've provided the readers with a map of the world showing all the different places, the so-called independent centers of domestication. And 50 years ago, there were only two, Old World, New World. Now we've got about 10. Not all at the same time, although certainly a lot of the dates that we're looking at on this map are very early. And there's some surprises. In New Guinea, we've got the first evidence for bananas and taro and yams about 7,000 years ago. Taro is kind of a leafy plant that people eat there. Nobody thought until about 4 years ago, really, that New Guinea had been much of a center for domestication of anything, and now we have three very, very important crops that we find out were independently domesticated there.
So why was all this happening at this time, Michael?
Well, that's what archaeologists are really debating now. It does appear to correspond with the beginning of the Holocene and the end of the last ice age. But after that, why people decided to give up foraging and begin farming is really still a bit of a mystery. Some people stress the climatic or environmental factors. Other archaeologists stress social factors, such as the rise of symbolism or religion or even kind of the internal dynamics of the increasingly sedentary societies that began to farm. We don't know the answer yet, and that is very much an area of active research.
Well, Michael, thanks for being with us today.
Okay, you're very welcome.
Michael Balter writes about new views of the agricultural revolution in the June 29th issue of Science. Human domestication of natural species goes well beyond plants, of course. Animals, landscapes, and even entire ecosystems have been subject to human control. Over human history, these domestications of nature have generally been net positives to humankind. But as Peter Kariva and three colleagues explain in a review article in this week's Science, humanity may finally have turned a corner, as the harmful impacts of domestication are starting to outweigh its human benefits. Dr. Kariva joins us on the line from Seattle. Dr. Kariva, welcome to the show.
Well, good morning.
Well, let's start with some sense of the scale here, if we could. You talk a bit in your review about the so-called global footprint of humans. Could you describe that footprint for us?
Sure. There's a couple ways of looking at it. One way is if you visit different places on the planet, what signs can you find of human influence? And those signs would take the form of invasive species, of roads, of logging, of maybe pollution, all sorts of different signs of impact. And when people have done that analysis, they basically find that virtually the entire planet has been impacted by humans, over 80%, and the only places that haven't are the hottest and coldest and most inhospitable places, places we can barely live in. And my guess is if we looked there, we'd still even find signs of our impact, certainly because of some pollution that is wide-ranging and can't be contained. So one way of looking at it is that you just can't go anywhere and find pristine nature or untainted and untouched by human nature. And the range of our impacts, of course, varies enormously, but the notion of pristine nature really is just a myth.
So, we, you know, as you suggest, we've almost domesticated the planet, if you will, and these domestications of nature presumably involve some trade-offs of human goods versus problems for the natural world.
Yeah, that's right. The reason I like to emphasize the trade-off point of view is that sometimes when you hear environmentalists talk about environmental problems, they almost make it sound like, how stupid the human race is, or how greedy and selfish the human race is, and they paint it in such a simplistic way. And really what has happened is we've fed ourselves, we've sheltered ourselves, we've built cities, you know, which have culture and sometimes a high quality of life. We've done all these things which are good for us, and in the process some parts of nature are harmed. And so it's not a matter of just massive ignorance destroying the planet. You know, we could feed ourselves better than we ever have been able to feed ourselves. On the other hand, in the process of doing that, there's no doubt that other things that nature gives us, biodiversity, clean water, prolonged soil fertility, that other things that nature gives us are traded off. We suffer, we lose some of them. And as you mentioned in your introductory remarks, one of the points of our article is that the trade-offs seem to be shifting so that the net balance is that we may be losing more than we gain. And once you see that, you really want to start examining them from the point of view of how do we manage these trade-offs so that on net, it still turns out to be a good bargain for us.
So in a sense, we're coming to a point where the trade-offs are actually harming the sort of goods to humankind that might come out of these domestications.
It's not just
a question of nature, as it were.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That was the big finding of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessments. We're just coming to a point where the trade-offs seem to be taking a real downward turn.
You know, you mentioned cities a few moments ago, and you talk about them in your article as particularly intense areas of domestication, which I guess is not a way I've really looked at cities before.
Well, I think cities are an important thing for conservationists and ecologists to pay attention to and to recognize cities have nature and influence nature. You know, this year is the first year that the majority of people on the planet live in cities. And people who live in cities really make decisions about how all of nature is domesticated, whether they realize it or not. One of my favorite stories is you know, New York City, what was it? I think it was like 1890 or roughly around there. A fellow brought in a Central Park, starlings, because he wanted Central Park to have every bird that was in Shakespeare's plays. And, of course, now starlings are a pest in all of North America. There's over 200 million of them, and we try to get rid of them. But it was this gentleman's, you know, urge to fashion Central Park in a certain way. And some cities and suburbs allow hunting in their vicinity, and other cities and suburbs don't allow hunting. And there's huge consequences of that for deer populations and for over-browsing and everything. So cities are where most of us live, and decisions made about cities impact all the world's trade-offs and nature.
Well, you also discuss another interesting element of this, national parks and nature reserves, which I guess are maybe not so natural after all.
Yeah, probably most people who visit natural parks realize that, but sometimes it's lost that most natural parks require a lot of management. It's not a case where you take a piece of land or water, if it's a marine protected area, and you just set it aside and say, this is a park. We're not going to have buildings in it, or we're not going to have commercial activity, and it goes forth. Some of the most spectacular national parks, like Kruger Park in Africa, require huge management investments to maintain the wildlife that people come to watch. And Similarly, almost all parks are visited. They're parks because they're valued by humans, and they're visited by humans sometimes in extraordinary rates, so that there's many parks get millions of visitors a year, which is, you can't think of then of that national park being a pristine piece of nature.
Okay, so we have this situation, if I'm understanding it, where pretty much all of nature has been domesticated to one extent or another, and the cost-benefit trade-offs of domestication, as you mentioned, are getting increasingly problematic. So what do we do about all of this?
Well, I think there's two things. One is we frame the way we look at the world and conservation and environmentalism slightly differently. Often the way it's framed now is we want to protect nature, and we want to maintain nature in some mythical historical condition of untainted or pristine nature. And I'm saying, don't even think about it that way. We can't protect nature from people. People are part of nature. They're in it. So instead of that view, you should be looking towards what is the future you want, not how can we keep nature like it was 500 years ago, but recognizing our impacts, what is the nature we want 100 years into the future? Too often, environmentalists and conservationists just live in the past. They want to keep things as it was, and that's just not possible. And the second thing is more scientific. And as a scientist, I think what's interesting is to start to assemble quantitative data and information about these trade-offs, and we should start trying to systematically understand, is it true that every time we select for productivity, whether it's in a forest or a farmland, is it inevitable that then it becomes more vulnerable to disasters? I can't answer that question. And the answer to that question is important, because if it's not inevitable, then we should identify the situations where it isn't, and that's the direction in which we should go.
Dr. Kareva, thanks very much for joining us today.
Okay, great.
Peter Kareva is the author, with three colleagues, of a review on human domestication of the natural world. The article appears in the June 29th issue of Science. And while we're on the subject of domestication, a new paper published online this week by Science finally solves the mystery of the origin of one of humanity's favorite domesticated species, the house cat. Previously, it's been extremely difficult to tease out the domestic feline's origins, owing to its tangled history of hybridization and breed development. But now, a research team including Carlos Driscoll and Stephen O'Brien of the U.S. National Cancer Institute, David MacDonald of the University of Oxford, and 10 colleagues has analyzed the nuclear and mitochondrial DNA of 979 domestic and wild cats. By studying the genetic markers within the genomes, the group found that the feline lineages that ultimately gave rise to the domestic cat originated more than 100,000 years ago in the Near East and were derived from at least five founders across that region. Cats were subsequently domesticated in the region much later, probably at the same time that agricultural villages were rising there, some 9 to 10,000 years ago. The domestic cats were then spread worldwide as their human companions wandered and migrated. The evolution of human cooperation also implies the evolution of another institution, punishment, to discourage non-cooperative behavior. But how does punishment itself actually become established in human groups? In the June 29th issue of Science, Christoph Hauert, Carl Siegmund, and three colleagues propose an answer to that question, and thereby cast further light on the evolution of cooperative institutions. We're very pleased to have Dr. Siegmund on the line with us now from Vienna to talk with us about the new paper. Dr. Siegmund, thanks for joining us.
I'll do it with pleasure. Yes, thank you.
Dr. Siegmund, take us through the broad issue here. Why is the evolution of punishment such a perplexing topic?
Well, essentially, it is because punishment in general is a rather costly activity. It takes energy, it takes time, the other guy might retaliate, and so on. And the temptation is not to pay these costs and to let other people punish the wrongdoers. So you see that in most institutions, for instance, in public transportations or tax offices, and so if somebody defects by not contributing the due share, then there is a lot of mechanisms for punishing such persons. But the interesting thing is that in stages where there is no such institution, where people are on their own, they are nevertheless frequently willing to punish each other. This is called peer punishment by some of my colleagues. And this is quite interesting. Why should you do it?
So in a sense, the problem we have is we have a costly activity here that seems to arise in these human institutions. And the question is, why does it arise in the first place?
How did it start? Yes, you see, if you have reached a stage where everyone is punishing the dissidents who do not contribute or so on, this is a very stable situation. But at the beginning, before there was such a sanctioning institution or such a system, it is more astonishing. If you are the first one willing to punish the wrongdoers, the defectors, you will have to punish left and right, and this is extremely costly.
And so you've attempted to try and find a way out of this by modeling this process mathematically. Now, how does such a model of a process like this work?
Well, basically, you model individuals and a society composed of individuals, and these individuals can take part in a public good game. This is a joint effort where they have to contribute, and they get something in return. And they also have the possibility of imposing fines on other players, on those who do not contribute. And in addition, we assume that these players, these agents, are imitating each other. More precisely, they are imitating those who have a higher success, a higher payoff. And we want to see how, in such a very elementary situation, punishing behavior can emerge.
But this isn't the first time that somebody's tried to model this situation. How does your model in particular differ from other models?
Most of the attempts so far have assumed that selection operates via groups. So in a group which is contributing a lot and a group which is very pro-social, we would imagine that it has in the long run a higher probability of survival than a group where people do not punish and where people do not contribute to the public good. But these group selection arguments are something that are always hotly debated. It seems that such an everyday behavior, like punishing those peers who do not contribute, should also be able to explain this by individual selection.
And so you've essentially set up a series of individual types, if you will, that attempt to explain the emergence of this group behavior.
Exactly. We have assumed, so to speak, the most complicated, the most difficult situation, where the players are anonymous, where they do not interact repeatedly, but just once, and where they are imitating those who have success and not simply those who are in the majority. And in that case, we managed to show that if players have the possibility not to participate in a joint enterprise, they are much more likely to evolve toward punishing the others and towards a stable society where everyone is contributing and everyone is ready to punish the exploiters, than if the players had obligatorily to participate in this enterprise.
So in a sense, what has happened here is you've included an element of free will in the model.
Exactly.
and the ability to opt out of the entire behavior without, you know, necessarily being a free rider.
Yes.
Who's taking advantage of what other people are doing.
Exactly.
That seems like a rather surprising result, actually.
Yes, it did surprise me a lot, actually. And in the beginning, I didn't believe it. But we convinced ourselves with several different methods that this was a real robust result. So other things being equal, a society where people are ready to enforce cooperation is more likely to emerge among individuals who can choose not to participate in this joint effort or so, who can voluntarily, on their own, opt out of the whole enterprise. This makes it much more likely that the enterprise will succeed.
Well, Dr. Zygmunt, I guess that's a good segue into some of the larger issues here. I mean, you closed your article with some interesting comments on how what you're describing relates to the whole notion of public goods and the so-called tragedy of the commons. These considerations are obviously becoming increasingly important as we come to grips with large-scale sort of public goods problems like climate change. I wonder if you could just comment briefly on some of those larger implications.
Sure. Yes, well, actually, climate change is a typical example of a type of public good or of a joint enterprise where we have to participate. This is something where we cannot opt out and choose another planet to live or so on. And therefore, it might be that this is one of the reasons why it seems so awfully hard to come to a consensus on this problem. On the other hand, one should not forget that in the models we have considered, we have assumed that the players were more or less anonymous, whereas here in real life, the nations and the firms are, of course, not anonymous. They know each other. There is a lot of public debates of these issues, and it could very well be that what does not work via punishment could work through rewards.
Well, a fascinating topic, Dr. Zygmunt. Thanks very much for joining us today to tell us about it.
Thank you.
Carl Zygmunt is the author, with Christoph Hauert and three colleagues, of Via Freedom to Coercion, The Emergence of Costly Punishment, a research report in the June 29th issue of Science. What will you be reading on the beach this summer? How about Robert Sawyer's medical thriller, Frameshift, or the real-life medical mystery, The Family That Couldn't Sleep, by D.T. Max, or A Guinea Pig's History of Biology, which tells the story of the life sciences from the point of view of the plants and animals that have been some of that story's central players. These are just three of 40 recommendations for summer reading, both fiction and nonfiction, from Science's advisory board, reviewers, and editorial staff. The list appears in the book review section of the June 29th issue of Science. Check it out before you pack for that summer holiday. Finally today, Eric Stockstad, the managing editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, is in the studio with Tanisha Riley of AAAS for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
Eric, it's good to see you this week. What interesting science topics do you have for us today?
We're going to talk a little bit about chimps and fossil wolves and weather on faraway stars.
Sounds pretty good. Let's hear about the chimps who may not be as selfish as we thought.
Okay, well, your image in your mind might be of chimps sitting in the forest picking nits off each other, which looks pretty happy and selfless. But even there, there's an expectation of payback. You pick my nits, I'll pick your nits, mm-hmm. so to speak. So it's not really altruism like humans do with anonymous donations to charity. You don't expect anything back. So this was an experiment trying to figure out if there really is selfless behavior in chimps. What they did was they had a chimp in a room and another room. It could look through a window and see a piece of watermelon that looked really good, but it couldn't get to it because the door was locked. Now imagine in the third room, there's another chimp that can see what's going on, and it has the power to unlock by pulling a pin, unlock that door, and let hungry chimp number one go after the watermelon. Does it do it?
Let's see. Does he?
Well, 80% of the time, it did. So, and that chimp got nothing out of this.
Interesting. So why is this finding important?
Raises some questions about when and where selfless behavior might happen in chimps. Now, one thing about this was that chimp had no expectation of being able to get food. So it could be that it's this idea of being able to get something or being hungry in the wild that really drives that selfish behavior.
And next, a story about an ancient uber wolf found preserved in Alaska.
All right, much as I like umlauts, let's call it a hypercarnivore.
Okay.
This is a fossil they found in Alaska in permafrost. It's about 12,000 years old. And the really interesting characteristics of this animal is that it had a short snout, a broad skull, and really big teeth. These are all features that suggest that the wolves were really good at bringing down big prey, like mammoth or bison. Unfortunately, about 12,000 years ago, humans and climate change meant that those prey were no longer available, so that the hypercarnivores went extinct.
Does this mean anything for the modern wolves?
Modern wolves aren't descendants of those hypercarnivores, but the interesting thing is that those modern wolves pulled through that period, and the reason is thought to be that they were generalists. They were able to take down a range of prey. So the big question for modern wolves is, are they generalist enough to be able to survive changes to habitat or future climate change?
And finally, we move away from chimps and hypercarnivores onto the weather on stars. You got to tell me about this one.
Okay, right. Good news for fans of the Weather Channel, but maybe not quite now. The reason people think there might be weather on stars, and they've suspected this might be the case for a century or more, is that if you look at stars that are all the same composition and about the same age, nevertheless, you see some variations in their atmospheres. So this team went and they looked at a star called Alpha Andromedae, which is about 95 light years away.
Now, how do you find weather on a star that far away?
Well, you need a telescope that's good enough. And with advances in instrumentation, they were able to resolve, look at the star for 7 years and look at variations in the composition. What they found was that levels of mercury were changing. They were changing in a way that sure looked like it was clouds of mercury moving through the atmosphere.
Well, Eric, thanks for dropping in and, as usual, sharing your interesting stories this week.
Thanks, Tanisha. It was great to be here.
Eric Stockstedt is the managing editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the June 29th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science, on behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Thanks for joining us.